1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's biggest rock albums. I'm Rhett Beard, and today in the studio, Canadian trio Rush follow up their most popular effort with Mixed Signals, clearly built for the future.
Looking for a new place for the guitar, and Alex was looking for a new way to play it and present it. So Signals is very experimental for us and for Alex, definitely. He has solidified such a great style on this album that's so unique.
He's wise enough to win the world, but fool enough to lose it.
For a long time, Rush was not the kind of band that got much airplay. There was not a lot of interest, usually got bad reviews. So a lot of people really hated the band, but there were also a lot of people that did like the band, that were inside the band as much as we are. Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
If Rush had not challenged themselves and their many fans in fall 1982 with the Signals album by continuing to innovate and expand their sound following their 1981 mega hit Moving Pictures, would there even be a Rush in the 21st century? Rush had painstakingly recorded 8 albums and toured tirelessly in support of every one, building a fiercely loyal cult following. But with back-to-back million sellers permanent waves in 1980, and then the blockbuster Moving Pictures, Rush risked their newfound fame and fortune with new arrangements and electronic instrumentation on 1982's Signals. Rush drummer and lyricist Neil Peart admitted to me that the success had some unforeseen consequences.
And each stage of our development has been a real struggle on our part, where we've been holding tenaciously onto our last level. And when we graduated to headlining the small theaters, you know, the vaudeville leftovers and so on, the 3,000, 4,000 seat theaters, we clung to that so tenaciously that we were starting to get so big that we were doing 3 or 4 nights in those places, 5 nights in those kind of theaters. And it just wasn't practical because there were so many other people who weren't getting to see us because we were spending 5 days in one city, you know. And it wasn't fair, really, when you came down to it, that people wanted to see us and couldn't. So you couldn't justify it anymore, you know. We couldn't say it was a compromise. It was a limitation that we faced, that too many people wanted to see us. It's not something we're able to control. So we were pushed into the arenas, basically, by the laws of supply and demand.
We'll be right back. subdivisions from the moving pictures follow-up Signals in 1982 was a clever play on words that dated back to their boyhood years in the Toronto suburbs. Here's Geddy Lee of Rush.
I think we long to break out of the boring surrounding of the suburbs and the endless similarities and the the houses after houses after houses that were the same, no trees, and you know what I'm saying, and the shopping plazas and all that stuff. And our way, I guess, of trying to be different and not wanting to conform was by growing our hair long, and this music that we were into sort of spoke to us in a way that was a vehicle for us to speak out against whatever you speak out against when you're a teenager. I mean, you know, that's part of teenage life is going through all these hormonal and psychological changes that you don't even know what you're doing half the time. I would describe us as, you know, the kind of kids that, you know, we were growing our hair, we were playing in a band, we thought we were kind of hip, I guess we thought we were kind of cooler than the next guy, but we probably weren't.
Rush had made a deliberate decision to hone their songcraft on their preceding album, and the result was the most radio play and highest sales to date. Geddy Lee again in the studio.
We were happy with the challenge of being able to write 20-minute pieces and being able to do sidelong works, and we'd done it a number of times by then, and we felt it was almost becoming a cross to bear for us in a way that it was almost limiting us in what we wanted to be. And we sort of tried to get back to our original desires as songwriters. I think we wanted to become a little more concise and be able to get our ideas across in a more concise and more contemporary manner. Music was changing. Rock music was changing dramatically at that point. There was a lot of bands coming in that were doing things quickly on a low budget and doing things very good, and also doing things that were rhythmically more interesting, and with the influence of reggae and white reggae and, you know, more sort of aggressive punk music that was coming out. And we very much wanted to be part of that. We very much wanted to learn what was going on and reflect the times as opposed to be left behind. Our ambitions were getting bigger in one sense, in the way that we eventually thought we could sound. And we suddenly accepted the fact that maybe there were other ways to enhance the sound of our band and other textures that we couldn't ignore from the technology that was growing up around us and existed in other areas of the music world. Alex and I would write music during the day, and Neil would work on lyrics. And in the evenings, we would come together and put the two things together. And really, that was the beginning of a technique or a writing method that we would use for many years after that.
Romantic wants to run the big machine. He's got a problem. trying to save the day for the old world man, trying to pave the way for the third world man. He's not concerned with yesterday. He knows constant change is here today. He's noble enough to know what's right,
Man was a hit for Rush off of the Signals album, which was this prolific, hard-working band's ninth release. For the first time, decisions for time constraints entered into the Rush concert set list, according to drummer-lyricist Neil Peart.
Of course, we give the nod to older things, but I think it was the Moving Pictures tour was the first one where we were unable to represent every album, and up to that point, that had been, as a principle, important to us, that every show would consist of something from every album that we'd made. Well, now we got to the point where that becomes impossible because, of course, we like the newer material better. But most important is the conviction we can bring on the stage with us every night. And that governs our choice of material very much. We look at songs, for instance, Moving Pictures is heavily represented because we still like playing those songs so much. So we have no desire to lose those songs, whereas other songs that perhaps are newer got tired a lot more quickly, you know? And there's things from Signals that have survived, and notably, Subdivisions, New World Man and The Weapon, I'm sure will be Rush classics in our repertoire in that sense. So those were obvious songs to keep because we still get a real pleasure out of playing them.
That was Rush drummer Neil Peart. Just like Elton John singing the lyrics of Bernie Taupin, Rush singer Geddy Lee faces an intriguing artistic challenge by virtue of the fact that all Rush lyrics are written by drummer Neil Peart. So I asked Geddy how difficult it is to express someone else's thoughts and feelings.
You take two kinds of attitudes when you're a singer, I think. The one is that you write the lyrics, or you believe in the lyrics that have been written so strongly that you become the same statement. You have to understand and agree in order to sing it with conviction, I guess is the term I'm looking for. And then there's the other point of view where you look at yourself as an interpreter of someone else's thoughts, and very much like an actor, you know, who takes a screenplay and goes out and he didn't write the words, but he's, to the best of his ability, trying to convey the feelings that person had written. So I think both those things come into play with my role in this band.
Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson talks about the lyrics of Neil Peart, who has experienced unimaginable personal losses.
You go through so many things in life, and you learn to deal with things, and you learn to not deal with things. And it's really a matter of more of dealing with everything that comes by, and knowing that you have the power and the strength to do it inside you. And it's an easy thing to say, and it's not always an easy thing to do, but that's the bottom line. You know, you overcome these things. Just keep at it, keep working at it. And I don't think he's preaching any kind of therapy, but he's talking about life experience, certainly. And you reach a certain stage in your life, certainly at the stage that I and most of my friends are at, where you start reevaluating your whole life and what it's all about. You know, it's something that everyone goes through, and it just suddenly happens, and so many things seem worthless. Because you have all the material to do it. You have it in you. Everybody does. We're all made of the same thing. And we can overcome any of these problems or obstacles in our lives, so long as we can depend on ourselves and we can love ourselves.
The Analog Kid was proof positive that the evolving sound of Rush on the Signals album was not at the expense of the ability to rock out. When we return, Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart learn to navigate through the maze of rock stardom with varying results. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the Signals by Rush.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks, guys. We're featuring Rush's ninth album, September 1982's Signals. The members of Rush have never been typical rock stars. They're quiet, unassuming, highly educated, serious musicians who, much like Pink Floyd, somehow sold millions of albums and concert tickets as an ensemble without a star frontman. But the back-to-back successes of Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures was threatening that anonymity, according to Rush singer, bass player, keyboard player Geddy Lee.
Probably more of Neil's, his feelings about being in the limelight and his difficulty with coming to grips with fame and autograph seekers and a sudden lack of privacy and sudden demands on his time. He was having a very difficult time dealing with. I mean, we all were, but I think he was having the most difficulty of the three of us adjusting. And in the sense that, you know, I think he's more sensitive to more things than Alex and I are. You know, it's harder for him to deal with those interruptions on his personal space and his desire to be alone. Being very much a person who needs that solitude, to have someone coming up to you constantly and asking for your autograph is a major interruption in your own little world. Well, I guess in one sense that we're a little bit like misfits in the fact that we've chosen this profession that has all this extreme hype and self-hyping world that we've chosen to live in, and we don't feel comfortable really in that kind of a role.
We'll be right back. The grandeur of the Rush song Chemistry is spectacular from the 5.1 surround sound mix on the DVD audio found in the Sector's 3 box set. Writing on AllMusic.com, Greg Prado notes that, and I quote, "More current and easier to grasp topics like teen pressure and repression replaced their trusty old sci-fi inspired lyrics," end quote. Rush drummer lyricist Neil Peart took a big tent approach on Signals.
I try to cover everybody. No, I really do. I look inside myself and I look at my friends. I look at my family. I look at the people that work for us. I look at our audience. I look at the cities we travel through, people I see on planes. People in Europe, I mean, it's limitless, really, and try to get inside their lives a little bit sometimes. I can see an incident or I can see a particular interplay between people, and it will suggest a universal thing, and that's what's important. And when I look inside myself, I don't ever want to write introspective lyrics because I think that's immoral, or there's something wrong with that, looking inside and writing about myself, you know, and I try never to do that. But if I can find something in myself and see it again in my friends, or maybe see it in our audience, or see it somewhere else in the world, then that I want to have, you know, a thing that I have in common, perhaps a parallel that I can draw between my experience and other people's, or issues that affect us all too. You know, there's things that you read in the paper, things that you see in the news that are really outrageous. And in the course of everyday life, it's so easy to forget them. You know, you can watch all those people get murdered. And at the time, everybody in the world is outraged and all the people on the street give their little speech on TV and the news, you know. And then they go home to the pressures of their lives, and they have to get up and go to work the next day, and their boss is hassling them, and all these realities of life that should not and cannot be denigrated. I mean, I know how large they loom in your life when you're subject to them, but at the same time, you can't afford to forget about the big things, you know. And it's an issue that I've made over and over again. And going back to a line in Natural Science, it reminds me of that living in their pools, people forget about the sea. It was the analogy then about tide pools, where small aquatic life get washed up into little tide pools, and then the tide goes out, and for them the world suddenly becomes that tiny little area. And for people it is that way too, you know, their town or their city is the universe, and they judge what's happening by that. And it's everywhere. I mean, you see that kind of provincialism in America, in Canada, in Western Europe, all over the place, where it's shocking to someone who travels as much as I do and sees everybody's troubles, you know, not just one city's or one state's. I look at them all and hear about them all, so consequently it's impossible for me to take that narrow of a view. But at the same time, I have friends who are unemployed, and I have friends who are having difficulties in their lives, so I want that to come out too.
The Signals album reflected the growing trend in the post-punk music world toward a reassessment of the 70s guitar hero, according to Rush drummer, lyricist Neil Peart.
We were all looking for a new place for the guitar, and Alex was looking for a new way to play it and present it. So Signals is very experimental for us and for Alex, definitely. I think he has solidified such a great style on this album that's so unique. I mean, obviously, all of us are influenced by other kinds of music. We'll never be so arrogant as to say we're not. And so we listen a lot, and we want all of that in our music. You know, anything we like, we want to have. So it's kind of a musical greed that we go around plundering things stylistically. And for Alex, he wanted to find a new place for himself as a guitar player and not be reenacting a cliche of a 60s or 70s guitar hero, but to truly continue to change and evolve. So I think with this time on it, as you say, he's evolved a more rhythmic way of looking at solos, more melodic, and so much more unique. You know, I'm very proud of what he's done as a guitar player on this album. Has really, I think, established a new way of approaching playing lead guitar, because we weren't ready to throw all of our abilities away. You know, there was a school of minimalism that grew up in the late 70s that tempted a lot of musicians toward it, and they just threw away everything they've learned. And we were not ready to do that, but we were certainly ready to change it and present it in other ways, so that the music that we were making now still continues to progress in a purely technical sense, but our instinctive ability to handle it is so much more refined now. And for Alex, the guitar player, that holds true still. He wants to do guitar solos. We want him to do guitar solos. A good guitar solo is a very exciting thing, but no one wants, you know, a 60s sort of burnout fast guitar solo anymore, so it's necessary to find new ways to do it. And for me as a drummer, I had to follow the same sort of evolution too. We've all been through the speedy technical side of drumming. I don't want to be a cliche of that either. I don't want to be a parody of myself 10 years ago. I have to find new ways of looking at it too, and we ended up, I think all of us, following the same path towards that.
good example of Rush exploring all four corners of the studio is The Weapon, part of the Fear trilogy on Signals, which rose to number 10 on the Billboard album chart by selling over 1 million copies in 2 months. Still to come, Alex, Neil, and Getty discuss how Rush expanding their sound in the studio presented a dilemma in concert. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the Signals by Rush.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Getty Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
Thank you, gentlemen. As Rush studio albums became increasingly sophisticated in the 1980s with synthesized keyboards, it became a daunting challenge for the three to pull these arrangements off in concert. So it begged the question, would Rush add a fourth musician for the tours? Here's Getty Lee in the studio with the answer.
Well, at the time, we thought if we talked about it, and I think that we sort of felt that if we were going to add a member, we would add a permanent member, and that we didn't really like the idea of bringing a guy along with us that sort of was hidden behind the curtains to play an instrument. We saw that more and more with other bands that were touring with us, and it didn't hit us the right way. We felt there was something uncomfortable about that. So we sort of felt that if we were going to do it, we were going to do it all the way. And because we thought that, we didn't want to do it at all. You know, it's a sort of roundabout way of getting to the answer, but that's sort of what happened. And we were very uncomfortable with the thought of bringing another personality in to what we felt was a very good working relationship.
The increasingly complex musical arrangements would continue to evolve into the rest of the decade, particularly utilizing keyboards to the point where, in concert, Getty Lee would be forced to play keyboards, play bass pedals with his feet, all the while singing lead vocal. Talk about multitasking. I posed the question to guitarist Alex Lifeson if Rush ever considered adding a fourth member.
I think at that time, it was something new for us. We did a lot more on a record than we normally would have, and we were afraid about being true to the record live. So we did talk about it, whether it was time to actually bring somebody on the road, and decided, no, let's not disrupt anything. We'll work around it somehow, and we did. I tell you, those first 10 days in pre-tour rehearsals, you're going crazy. You know, everything sounds awful. First of all, you sound like a really bad copy band of yourself. Yeah, for starters. And then you've got to remember all the, you know, the pedals and all that stuff. But now, you know, you can read a newspaper while you're doing it, and it's always like that. So I don't think we'd ever actually add somebody live. Plus, being a three-piece for so many years, during a time where keyboards had not evolved, really, synthesizers, right, which are great space utilizers. They really take up a lot of space in the sound. We always had to do that right from the start. You know, I tended to play a lot of suspended chords, very broad chords, to fill more room, and, you know, the same with Getty's quick bass playing and Neil's very busy drumming. It just filled more area. So it was a good foundation for us. So I think we can really overcome any kind of obstacle like that. Besides, it's a challenge and it makes things more interesting.
Rush drummer Neil Peart.
Being a trio is something that is special to us, and I think it's special to our fans too.
It is.
I think if you're a band like Genesis, it's great to have other musicians and works excellently for them, but we are known as a trio. Our reputation has a lot to do with our live show and what the three of us can do live. And we're very proud of what we've been able to stretch a three-piece into being capable of doing. So it's something that is important to us, and our interrelationship is important to us too. And adding a fourth member on any basis, really, even if you only hire a keyboard player for the tour, it's still someone else that you're traveling with, someone else who is concerned about what you're doing. And we would be very hesitant to play with that because we've seen how difficult it is for other bands to get along. And we know that we are truly one of the few bands who are absolute friends, you know, in the truest sense of that word. We have, I don't think, ever run across another relationship that's like ours. And we're lucky that the songwriting gets divided up equally too, so there aren't political jealousies about whose song gets to be the B-side of the single and the other stuff that a lot of bands go through because they have one good songwriter and the other guys only want the publishing money. For us, we've split the work and we split the rewards. So there's, it eliminates that pressure and it eliminates solo albums and it eliminates somebody quitting the band for so-called musical differences. All of that stuff, you know, it's right out. So we're lucky.
Redbeard back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests, Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart of Rush. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. The transcription is by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net.